Hello, my friends. I'm curious to know how many of you have a leadership pipeline. We know that great leaders grow companies because we talk to them here on the show every day. But what are you doing to create great leaders within yours? If you're a CTO, it is 100% your responsibility to grow and improve your people beyond just their coding abilities. We've built a tool that improves your people in their craft and in leadership. Visit leaderbits.io to learn more. Today we are talking to Nick, the CTO of DropSolid, and we discuss making the transition from startup to enterprise, organizing your teams around people rather than projects, and connecting the dots between business processes as a CTO. All of this right here, right now on the Modern CTO Podcast.
Here we go!
This is the Modern CTO Podcast.
Where are you located?
I'm in Belgium. So it's 5 p.m. now.
Wow. How did you get there?
I live here. I was born here. So, nice. Yeah. I did travel around a bit to Boston and to Spain, but I ultimately ended up back home, basically.
Yeah, Boston's is growing, like as a huge tech area.
Yeah, it's massive.
Yeah. So what were you doing there?
I was working for Acquia. Acquia is, when I joined, it was a startup with, I think, 60 people. I think they're around 1,000 or 800 people right now in a year or four. So they were booming massively. So I was kind of recruited as an intern initially in Belgium, and then with a requirement to move to Boston to be part of the main office.
And what's their main goal there?
The main goal of Acquia is to, it's probably two parts. One is the main driver of making ambitious digital experiences with open source software, mainly with Drupal, if you've heard of that software.
Oh, of course. Yeah.
So the creator of Drupal is the CTO of Acquia.
Really?
Yeah. So that's how I ended up in that world. And that same software is still probably 90% of my working hour goals in the current company I work for. So it never really left me.
So how do you say his name? Dries? Is that how you say his name?
Dries. Or in Flemish, Dries. And his Dries. Last name is even more difficult. It's Bertaert.
Bertaert.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's just not how it looks like you would say it.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And so you got to work with him at Acquia when they first started?
Yes. So when they were, somewhat small, I joined. And then after a couple of years, as I lived a year in Boston, I moved back to Belgium and worked from a remote office for them. I really wanted to make a certain difference in the tech world in Europe because I saw that it was really difficult to grow adoption on a bigger scale in Europe as there's a lot more smaller to medium businesses in Europe compared to the US, which is kind of logical because you have all these small markets here in Europe. So if you want to grow big, you either have to do something really, really right, like Google or Facebook, or you probably will stay somewhat small.
What's the average size? Like 10, 15 people, 30 people?
Of an average small to medium business?
Yeah.
Probably 10 to 20. Maybe a lot of them will go up to 60, maybe 80, but it's difficult to go higher.
So do you find a lot of duplication then, like because there's these small clusters? Like duplication in ideas, like the same idea done over and over with different brands in different areas?
Probably yes, but because there's so many languages, not everyone will know.
Oh.
Because you don't really know what's going on in France, even though that's so close to you. I will probably even go further. We don't know in Belgium what's going on in the French part of Belgium because it's a different language and a very different culture, also business and tech-wise.
Really? That's something so unique because I don't have that here.
No, it's really unique. In the US, as far as I understand, it's quite easy for a person to relocate to some other state because that's where you got the job. And a lot of people do that, and it's a lot of fun, and it's always the same language, and most likely the same culture, more or less. I know there's some differences here and there, but that's
yeah, there's small differences, but they're not like unlivable. You know, like you can always find your group in every area.
But maybe if you move to Spain from Belgium, you have to learn Spanish. Because not everyone will know English.
Right.
And your own language will also not work at all. So that's very different.
Yeah, my sister moved to China and she has been there for a couple of years. And she's explaining to me how different it is, like culture-wise, language. And she just learned Chinese.
Yes, you have to, I guess. It's the same with businesses. And instead of languages, you have to learn how the culture works of your customers. It's very, very different to do business in Germany than in Belgium, than in Holland, than in France. You can't just build up a SaaS product and expect it to work in that culture. It's really tough.
So you did. You've been a Drupal computer. Drupal competitor or contributor. I'm still learning how to speak.
Yes, it seems like yes.
Right? I don't know what's going on. Yeah. Is Drupal is not a normal word? Is that what language is that from?
It's a funny story if you want to know.
I do.
So Dries is from Belgium as well. Mm-hmm. He first wanted to create a community, and he wanted to kind of name it to the Flemish word of a village, which is called Dorp, D-O-R-P. Mm-hmm. Now, he was registering the domain names, and he mistyped him, and he wrote D-R-O-P, which is drop. So then they started a little brainstorm and said, okay, how can we now use this in our advantage? And it became from drop in Dutch is Drupal. And to kind of like Englishify it, it became Drupal.
That is so amazing. That's why I like that word just threw me, because I say it in my head, but I don't say it, you know, out loud much, because, you know, when I'm reading and writing code, like you see it all the time. You can't not see it, right? So you've been contributing there for over a decade, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, right? Within Drupal, it's probably longer than 10 years right now.
So have you contributed to the source at all?
Sure. I basically did my master studies, or I don't know if that's the same name in the US.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the end goals there, usually you do some internship, but it was also like a massive project. So one of those massive projects was me to create kind of a better search ecosystem in Drupal 7 back then. So a lot of the searching and indexing code in a contributed module in Drupal came from me and guided by a couple, like a lot of other people in that Drupal space.
Yeah, go Nick.
Yes. But obviously, like then you learn to know a lot of other people. I got to learn a lot of other skills, and I grew into very different roles. So today, I have to admit, my contribution ratio went way down, unfortunately.
Well, that's okay, because you're contributing in other ways, right?
Right, yeah.
Yeah, so that's what you do. I mean, that's sort of like, we talk about this a lot. You know, when you're starting out and you're writing code, that's like your entry to the world, because... Mm-hmm. Once you show that you can contribute and bring value, that you're hard pressed to find people in like managers or executive positions now or senior leadership positions that didn't write code for a good chunk, because you have to understand where you're coming from, right?
Right. Yep. You have to understand the from the basis to these high level conversations. That's what I read in your book, by the way, as well. So
thank you
for that. Kind of confirmed what I was already thinking.
Yeah, it's so great. You know, I get about 3 people a day who write me now about the book.
Okay, that's good.
It's you know, because before you put it out, you're all, you know, nervous, like how's the world going to respond? You don't really know. And then when you start getting just an overwhelming amount of positive and like, you know, thanks for discussing, like it makes my day. Like that's kind of one of the things I scan for every day is those, you know, letters or those emails from people. It's just really, it's really, really cool. So you went from that, Acquia, and now you're CTO of Drop Solid.
Exactly. Yeah.
Now that's an easy name to say.
Yes, you probably hear the familiarity.
You
got it there as well. I'm not native, so yes.
By the way, your English, you sound like native speaking English. What's your native language?
It's Flemish. Well, Dutch.
Dutch. Yeah. Excellent. Yeah, your English is like on point. So,
probably of the years that I spent in the US. But yeah, so Drop Solid is also doing a lot of business development with Drupal. So that's
great.
How I got into that sphere as well. And they were focused on that small to medium market in Europe. So I saw that opportunity. I saw like the tech part I fully mastered somehow. Or you can never say fully mastered, but I was very confident at least.
Yes.
And then there was this position in okay, now like we need someone technical because we're in over our heads right now as the current owners. We cannot lead our dev team any further than what we already did right now. So that's where I stepped in. It fully like embraced that idea that I had that Europe needs to grow and that these small to medium markets also have so much opportunity to be more digital. I had that confidence of the technical level, and I had the opportunity to learn all these business processes and be like a lot more influential in a very different way.
So how did you meet Dominique? And by the way, I love that name Stain, because I have a friend in my city named Stain. Everyone wants to call him Stigeon.
Stigeon.
Everyone calls him because it's S-T-I-J-I-N. And I look here and I have two connections and I have two friendships in common with Stain.
What's his last name? Because we have a couple of Stans in the company.
Delancer?
Stan Delancer here, yeah. It's one Delancer? Of our project managers in the company.
Yeah, he shows up first on my LinkedIn because I know cool. Ben and some other people with him. But yeah, I saw...
I'll tell him.
Yeah. And by the way, Stain, the guy that's my friend in my town, he's like a really cool person. So I like him okay. a lot. Well, I don't even know where he's from. He's just... I saw that name and I'm like, I know that name.
So when we travel to the US or maybe when you come to London, I'll take him with me.
Yeah. We had some friends visit from Finland last month. That was really cool.
Cool.
So how did you meet Dominique? How did you get involved with the project? How did you meet him?
I think last year or a year and a half ago, I was somewhat frustrated with probably the growth of Acquia where it was. And there were some frustrations, which is kind of normal when you work in a company for 4 years. And I think for the first time in my life, I said yes to a recruiter on LinkedIn.
They're always putting it out there though, right?
Yes, they always try. But it was for a very different position. So obviously I said like, no, I'm not interested. I'm good where I am. But he kind of like said openly, look, it's for this company, it's with that person. Would you be willing to just even have a lunch with him? So I did, and Dominique explained me his goals and what he wanted to do with the company, all his dreams. Dominique is a very inspirational CEO in the sense that he has a lot of dreams. And obviously, with the people that we are right now, we will never achieve it. So we need to grow, and there's a lot of things ahead of us, which is very good to have if you're joining a new company.
So you go into the company. How did you get the current team to sort of accept you as their leader and to follow you?
Well, so because I was already somewhat known from the community, from the Drupal community.
Oh, you're a rock star there. That's right.
Yeah. Well, we don't like to use the word rock star because that gives a lot of pressure. And then we see a lot of people burn out because they want to be a rock star.
A leader. Then.
Yeah, so we need to be careful with these words, I guess. But at least I was somewhat known. So I didn't have to prove my technical ability initially. So the harder part was to kind of show that I was capable of defending them in business processes somewhat.
So were they getting a lot of change of direction from the leadership? And then you kind of have to come in and make sure that you can control the change so you can deliver stuff on time? Is that what it was?
Yeah, I think you can... maybe mention it like that. The hardest part was that it was a culture of who shouts the loudest, if that's something you can say.
Yeah.
And I worked really hard to move it into a certain agile flow that worked for that company. So every team has its own board, but they are being able to borrow out team members to another team if it gets busy. But it also then reflects into the financial reports of that specific team that they borrowed out that person. Because each of the teams in our company have a certain bookkeeping, if you will.
Yeah.
And they need to somehow also prove that they're profitable. But if there's...
Ooh, I like that.
If there's a lot of pressure in one team to finish a certain project because of a certain deadline of a company or a client that we work for, it's possible to loan another member from another team without impacting their profitability. So it was a very difficult system to set up in business processes. And I think that's also what I wanted to talk to you about, which was something I was missing a bit in your book, is that as a CTO, you're also responsible in connecting all the dots between all the different systems in a company. And like understanding in a 60 to 80 people company as we are in right now, it's already very complex. I can understand that if you're 100 or 400 people company, it's insanely complex. So that was my biggest challenge in the last year, is to connect all the dots and to make sure that there are systems and not frustrations and emotions.
That's correct, because after you get that down, the repeatable pattern, as you start, because you're in like a transition from growth to enterprise. So you have different problems to solve at each different level. When you're a startup and it's just you, you're developing the pattern for the actual code base, right? Because you're the lead developer. And then you bring, once you have that pattern established with you and someone else, you start adding people. And now you have the problem of going from startup to growth, which is where you're collecting teams, right? So now your core pattern for your software is solved, right? Like, you know what's going on, but now you have to organize people around working together and teams. And like you mentioned, the profitability. And then once you have teams, you start to get groups of teams. And that's when you're going from growth to enterprise. And now you have to have a system for organizing groups of teams. And then from there, it just goes as far as it can go. You got, unless if there's maybe another way to state it, but from what I've seen, all the way up to 10,000 people, you just get groups of teams. And once you've mastered groups of teams, it just can scale as far as you need it to go.
Right. And getting to that phase with those systems in place that kind of make sure that the team is stable and that there's enough control mechanisms for that team that they're able to control as well. So not as a system to kind of beat on them with a stick and say, go, go, go. That doesn't work. Need to be able to see the dashboards. They need to be able to control those dashboards. And I think even more important, they need to agree on what those KPIs are for them.
Well, they have to buy into them and believe
them. They
have to
buy in, yes. So that was a really difficult part as well. Like, what are KPIs for a development team that doesn't do their sales? So we have product teams, we have product integration teams. For product teams, it's easier because that's basically R&D. And you as a company know that you allocate a certain amount of your budget to R&D, and then you follow the regular agile flow of, okay, this is what our roadmap is, this is our capacity, et cetera, et cetera. But for those product integration teams, it's a lot more difficult, at least in my experience.
So tell me a little bit more about the product integration teams, what they do exactly.
So DropSolid has a certain install profile. And with those install profiles, we build these websites and integrations with other tools like Salesforce and competing systems like those. The R&D team builds that install profile and expands on them and has like the time to really dig in and take the time to do it well. Those integration teams, they use that software and build those ambitious experiences for those companies or those clients that come to us to say, like, look, we need this and we want all of this stuff to happen. There's another team, a strategy team in our company that says, well, client, maybe you should start small. That's already a very difficult conversation. And then obviously it needs to happen.
So the product team is sort of like building the in Ruby, I'd call it a gem, right? It's sort of building the connection with the Salesforce or with whatever. And then the product integration team is actually building the client's needs on top of that.
Exactly.
Using that tool.
Yeah. Okay. Maybe the name in some companies, professional services versus product teams, depending on how you call it. And that's also a transition that the company made since I got there. Before that, they only had professional services. But obviously, if you only have that team or that division, you're always building from scratch. And that's not very profitable.
Well, so, and they're different types of developers typically.
Yes.
You'll want different people. You'll want the people that are building those gems to be building gems all day.
Yes.
Yeah, right. And then you'll want the people who are doing the client part doing that all day. It's just who they are as far as people. So then how did you solve the problem? Did you take the finances of what the client is paying for the experience and then put that as their sort of KPI, like a portion of that budget, and say you can't spend more time than this? Or how did you come about the resolution of that?
No, so there's a couple of different KPIs, and there's a project manager that obviously takes care of the scope. And the team itself, does the whole sprint planning or the project planning, but we don't plan like the full project. And depending on how the project is sold, it could be that we're selling sprints. So we're not committing a certain scope and time, because if you commit to scope and time, then you're probably killing your business.
Yeah, no, I found that out real fast.
Yes.
that was like 10 years ago I learned that.
Yes, right. So that's also something that we don't do anymore. Or if we do that, it's actually with a different part of our business, which is called Cool Drops. And Cool Drops is for the small businesses, and that's purely productized. So it's kind of going to the supermarket and say, in my website, I want this and that and that. And the junior developers that start in our company are in charge of building those websites. So there, it's okay to do it in scope and time, because we know the end result and we know how long it takes to build that end result. So that's a very different. Yeah, it's a predictable process. The bigger developments are not very predictable. So there, we sell them, if we can, in sprints. Otherwise, we sell them in packages and say, like, this is must-have, et cetera, et cetera. And we kind of commit on at least having the must-haves in a certain budget. Now, how the team does its KPI is that they have sprints. And it could be that teams work on different projects at the same time in the same sprint. So what I've seen in a lot of companies is that you organize your team around a project and not around people. But the difficulty is basically working together with people. And I don't know if you've encountered that in your interviews. It's not something I read a lot about yet in the book, but I did in other books. And if you organize your team around people and you put like different projects in it, but you say, okay, from the start until in 2 weeks, this is the amount of stories that we want to finish. And we as a team commit to finishing these amount of stories. Okay, fine. After three of those 2 week periods, you can have an average. And that's the basic Scrum philosophy. If you take your average of the last 3 weeks, of the last three sprints, you can most likely predict how much you can handle in the next two. If your sizing of these stories is somewhat accurate and similar to your previous sprints. So what the KPI is for those teams is to keep that number, the average amount that they can do on a full-time engineer division basis, stable.
You said something that really piqued my interest. You said organize around the project versus the people.
No, organize around the people, not the project.
Oh, okay. Sorry. I wrote it wrong.
Yeah. So the teams are stable, but it could be that projects move within teams, or it could be sometimes that you as a team borrow someone from another team, but that one person still is part of the other team, even though it's borrowed to another team. It sounds complex, but for those teams, it's really useful to identify themselves with a team. And not as I'm just a part of a chess game where I'm needed for a company.
Oh, it creates this sense of clarity and certainty because, yes, you know, this is my team, but right now I'm doing something different than where I belong.
Yes.
And that way you always know where to go back to your tribe, right?
It's your tribe, basically, yes. Yep. And that really helped some bring some stability in the company.
Now, how do you structure leaders within your teams?
So there's different roles. There's an architect role, there's a Scrum Master role, and there's an estimation engineer role. The last one is some role that we invented ourselves.
Yeah, we've all been there.
Yes. So.
you're like, we need this person to just be giving estimations because we're spending all of our quality doers' time, right?
Yeah.
Creating estimations.
Well, so those people with those roles are basically responsible of the output of that team when it comes to that subject. So it doesn't mean that no one else in that team is able to do estimations. It just needs to pass through that gate of that person.
That's smart. The best roles form out of necessity.
Yes. But it was difficult to find out, like, what's the structure and how can we make sure that we have this quality assurance in terms of not just code quality, because that's kind of an obvious given. And there's so much lectures and sources to find online as like continuous integration and all those things. that's the easy part. The hard part is to commit on, okay, what did we do? Did we do it right? And is the value that we bring to that customer the value that he wants? Like, I'm sure you know that cartoon where someone wants to build a sling for a kid, and then it becomes a sling with a tire, and then ultimately it's a really horrible sling because it always gets passed through other people, but in the end, the kid is not happy.
Right. They say the horse designed by a committee is a camel.
Something like that, yes.
Yeah. So. You get a group of people to design a horse, it'll look like a camel with all the humps and the lumps and everything. No, and I find that there's a lot of companies that'll say, oh, we do Scrum or oh, we do Agile. And you go there and it's like, yeah, you log your issues in Pivotal, but this is not what Agile and Scrum is. You're just using Pivotal as a to-do list.
Yes. Yeah. Yes, and that's also something I brought in, not just in the development teams, but also in the marketing team, the sales team. Because if you try to do this methodology right, which is like bringing the right value to that customer in a predictable time, more or less, you need to be able to sell it as well as a salesperson. And that was also really challenging for me. Like, how do you explain all these methodologies to a very different group of people that I've never interacted with before?
Right.
That was difficult. And not just explaining it, but also make sure that they use it themselves as well in maybe the most basic form, because you cannot force to go like all the way for certain teams. But at least having a backlog, having an understanding of how long something takes, more or less, is difficult.
Having something that is being used properly is better than having nothing at all. And then it's also about, you know, injecting it here and there and slowly building, because you can definitely kill the morale and make it over complicated and getting people like frustrated. And then you have to deal with the human part of angry people, right?
Yeah. So you have to be very careful, not go too quick.
So how large is your team currently?
The company is 75 people right now. There's 60 full-time employees, and there's a bunch of interns right now. So it's kind of skewed towards interns in this period, but in the summer it'll probably go down to 65, but we're intending to grow.
How many of those are developers?
There's 30 developers, I think, 30 to 35.
I see you have like 5 or 6 teams.
There's 5 teams indeed. So there's the 3 professional services teams, or the solutions integration team. There's an R&D team. There's this Cool Drops team, which is the junior developers. And there's also like the infrastructure team, which I didn't count yet. But it's also very important because they're kind of the backbone for all those teams.
Ooh, explain that one. I'm curious.
So the infrastructure team is responsible for the whole server infrastructure on which the solution teams basically build their products on, or the client projects on. And their responsibility is, at least what I told them, is to become useless. As in sense that they shouldn't be needed on a daily basis. And that's also a really difficult problem to solve. And maybe you can call it with fancy words like DevOps, but you cannot put all your infrastructure in the software development teams, because that's also very frustrating. Like, you don't want to do Linux kernel updates or any of those things in your professional services teams.
That's true.
Yeah.
Yeah. So have you started sharing any of your knowledge through talks or writing?
So that's interesting. So in July, there is a Drupal Developer Days event in Lisbon. Mm-hmm. And I proposed a session. And let me see if I'll send you the link in email. But it's called like a developer's flight over the cuckoo's nest. Basically my story that I'm telling you on this podcast as well, on how I got from that developer to the role that I'm in right now, and how can you scale a company with Drupal and all these different connections, this agile flow. So I'll make that presentation public as well, and it will be recorded.
Right, so that's in July?
That's in July, yeah.
Excellent. You're going to do great, man. Are you presenting it in English?
It's in English, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I loved all the different parts of it. I think you just nailed it.
Thanks. Yes.
Yeah, with a cold too. It's like you're.
You can hear it, my cold.
No, but you said it. But I'm saying, if you have a cold, that's like an athlete training. You're training under harsher conditions than where you're going to have to perform. right?
There is actually a Drupal company in Iceland, so maybe they get that credit of training under very harsh conditions. But
oh man, they like have their people out hauling ice and stuff, and
maybe, yeah, to keep the servers cold, it could be, yeah.
Yeah, I always said that. I said, look, if I talked to a bit mining company who was asking me about putting solar panels on their building, and I said, well, your company is in Florida, so solar panels are great, but I would just like go put the building on an ice cap somewhere.
Yes.
Because to Florida, Florida's so hot. I mean, the average temperature is like 83 degrees, 85 degrees year round. And I mean, it gets hot. You're paying a lot of money for air conditioning. I was like, just go put it in like Antarctica or, you know, somewhere reasonable that's freezing.
I think
freezing.
I read that like some Chinese companies moved to Canada for those Bitcoin mining rigs. So maybe cheaper in the end for energy. I don't know, but they moved from China to Canada, probably because it was cheaper.
Yeah, you don't have to cool it. I'll tell you, I live in a very hot area. Do you live in a cold area or a warm area?
Average.
Average?
I think similar to New York, but less snow.
Okay. I live in a place that never gets snow. It's like a tropical area, right? So, I mean, on Christmas, you can go to the beach. It's like 70 something on Christmas, right? So that's the type of the area I live in. But in the summers, it gets very hot. So it's either warm or hot.
Okay.
And so you don't want servers here at all. It's expensive to cool them.
But Amazon or Google doesn't have a data center over there because they are so busy with those regions.
But they'll put them on on a city on the water. So, no, thank you so much for hanging out and talking. And if people want to find out more about you, which they definitely do because you're awesome, how, other than looking through the Drupal source code, right? How would they learn more about you?
On LinkedIn, I think there's some profile information. I also have my own website, but I really need to take care to update that with much more recent information. So I wouldn't recommend you to go there yet. But yeah, LinkedIn is a great source of contacting me if you'd like to meet me or maybe have a conversation on how you think I could improve, or maybe if you need some information on how we do things in our company. I'm very open to show you all the mechanisms and tools that we have.
That's what it's all about, because those were tools that were not easy to come by. You had to figure it out. And so now it's kind of like what we do as people in our community, we share with the other generation so that we can grow.
APIs are key. Like if you are not using APIs or if you're using tools that don't have APIs, please stop using them.
Wait, you mean screen scraping isn't like something we should
just like don't do it. Yeah, so.
But that was the whole 2000s though, man.
Yes. And we're still doing it. Like we're building a scraper right now, just to understand our competitor landscape. To understand like what is the system that competitors use, what clients are using those competitors. So we're still doing that. But that's I think a valid use case.
You doing anything with Nokogiri or any Ruby stuff? Or
I did some Ruby back at Acquia, but never really like fully in depth. I'm more into Golang or a little bit of Python because we do a lot in infrastructure with Ansible.
Yeah.
So that's more my go-to technologies.
I saw Golang for the first time about five to 6 years ago, like right when it first came out, I think that's when it came out. But I was at a developer talk, like a meetup, and the guy had written a program in Golang for a satellite that was up in space. And he actually, in the talk, he rotated the satellite with Golang functions.
That's awesome.
It was so, I was like, oh my, and he explained how Golang was written to be like the first language that I'm digging back 6 or 7 years ago. So let me try to get this right. It was a language that was written on the concept of, oh, this is how a language would be if we did it when we had multi-threaded processors. Is that the point?
Yes, that's
something like that.
Something like that. But the more appealing part for Golang for me was that it's a single binary. And you can compile it for any system. And that, in combination with the modern cloud systems like Amazon and Google, is a perfect match because it can scale horizontally because it's a single binary. It doesn't really care where it's hosted or where it is. So it's perfect for these containerized environments. Whereas Drupal is a software that's probably predating Golang as this.
Oh yeah, yeah, Drupal's old.
Yeah, architecture, and it's using also file systems, and it's very complex in what it requires from a system. So it's a lot harder to containerize or cloudize, if that's even a word.
That's a word now.
Yeah, that's a word now. So it's really hard to scale that. And there's some companies like Acquia, like I think Pantheon also in the US that are doing this, but then for enterprises. But smaller scale companies don't have the money to even pay for that. So
I'm excited to see the talk. When you do it, you got to videotape it and then post it.
They will record it for sure. So yeah. No worries. I send you the link in the chat in this podcast, but maybe you can also post it if you publish this.
Oh, of course. Yeah, I'll post it in the show notes. We post show notes, so we'll say what we talked about and everything like that. Yeah, I mean, Nick, I like you. I can't wait till I'm out in your area. I'm going to stop by and see you.
Yeah, come to Belgium. Come to our office.
We'll have some waffles.
Yes, and chocolate and beer.
Oh, all the great things,
all the great things in life, yes.
Awesome.